With the global economy still in recovery, let's look at an interesting counter-economy.
They started off as the anarchists who are organizing this event, and they basically had to become the government.
It's Burning Man, an annual community that springs up in the desert over Labor Day, then vanishes, and no money is allowed. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Economists around the world are predicting modest growth in the global economy, though the political battles in Washington over Obamacare had foreign governments keeping their fingers crossed. Banks are shedding debt, according to a Reuters article. Italy's economy is still stagnant, and Japan, they say, plans to raise a consumption tax to try to reduce its debt. But what's the alternative? One example is a counterculture city that springs up in the Nevada desert each year, then disappears as quickly as it was built. The Burning Man Festival carries on the idealistic spirit of the 60s while dealing with the challenges of a hyper-connected consumer society. Whether you think it's hippie nonsense or an interesting exercise in a no-commerce economy, there's no denying it's growing.
In case you haven't heard, Burning Man is a giant art festival and party that takes place in Nevada's Black Rock Desert every August. Tens of thousands of people come out here in the 100-degree heat to build what they call a temporary community. It really is like a little city. There are bars, restaurants, newspapers, radio stations, a post office, just about anything you could imagine, except one thing.
No commerce is permitted. You cannot exchange goods for money.
Larry Harvey is the creator of Burning Man.
And building on that positively, we encourage the giving of gifts. You should come prepared to give gifts.
People do come with gifts of all types. They range from homemade jewelry handed out to strangers to a 7-course meal prepared for whoever passes by. Skip, who camps with a group called the Elders, explains his group's gift to the Burning Man community. Every afternoon, they host an event called Brie, Bach, and Talk. They provide the brie and put on classical music.
People come in and we sit and talk about whatever people talk about. And we have good interactions. So it's our gift to the community, but it's the community's gift to us also.
Food and drinks are a popular gift here at Burning Man. A group called Camp Unofficial has their own twist.
And the most important part, of course, is we'll be making snow cones daily during the heat of the day.
There's also interactive installations, musicians, performance artists, and giant art cars that serve as both carnival rides and transportation around the city. No one gets paid to do any of this, not one penny. Burning Man founder Larry Harvey says the festival's history helps explain why it's still commerce-free.
We went out originally with just a small band of people, and probably not more than 40, 60 people, and people more or less all knew one another.
It was all like a big group barbecue or a camp out in the woods.
If you went camping with your family, you know, it wouldn't even be appropriate. If your grandmother, you know, came to the picnic and wanted an olive, you wouldn't sell it to her.
For the first few years, Burning Man had a pretty intimate vibe, even with a few thousand people.
And then one year, someone we didn't know, who came only to sell goods and had never been to the event, which is okay, we welcome strangers, but he set himself up away from the center so he could discreetly do business, and he vended fireworks to people. And it was such a discordant note. You know, I mean, it was as if someone came to the family picnic and said, Granny, you want some potato salad? That'll be $2.99. So we just outlawed commerce. And then from there was the realization that it was the passage of gifts that was opening people's hearts, that was bonding people together, that had a way of civilizing a space, because more and more people who we didn't know began piling in. But if you get a gift from a stranger, you're immediately bonded to them. In fact, oftentimes, gifts from strangers are moving more than than from people who really, who you think might be obliged to you in some way.
There are 10 basic principles that all participants at Burning Man are asked to observe. One of them is gifting. When they first started promoting this value, Harvey says lots of people would bring little plastic trinkets or other cheap, funny, but somewhat meaningless gifts. Many still do, but Harvey's inspired to see the gifting is moving in a more utilitarian direction.
People carry lip balm around, and when they see somebody whose lips are beginning to crack in the desert, which can be very painful, or they'll bring socks, and someone's feet are, you know, not faring well because they've been imprudent enough to walk around in alkaline sediments without their shoes on, they'll give them socks.
Harvey laughs at the idea that our society could exist without money, but he says we do need to return to some basic human values, like sharing and seeing each other as part of a larger human family. Even with all the fire-shooting distractions, that's one lesson learned at Burning Man that people can bring with them back home.
A gift well given opens a heart, and it requires an open heart to give it. And it's proved contagious, and it generates a spirit that for many, by their own testimony, is life-transforming.
Steve Brown and Jesse Dieter produced a documentary profiling the Burning Man Festival. They came at the project from different points of view. Brown is a Burning Man veteran. Dieter, a filmmaker, had never been. They spoke with Andrea Chase.
Before you go the first time, you've heard about it, you sort of have a vague idea of what it's like, but how does that compare to the actual experience of being there for the first time for each of you?
I think the first general comment when people get there is, wow, I had no idea. It is far bigger, grander. The scale of everything is just way beyond anything that you might have seen in a YouTube video.
I unfortunately had too much idea because I'd had a lot of friends who'd gone to Burning Man over the years. And I'd also spent the year before I went to Burning Man to work on this project exhaustively researching, looking at footage. I'd probably seen more images of Burning Man than most other people have in their entire lives before I got there. So I knew, unfortunately, a little bit what to expect, but I was terrified because I was effectively helping Steve lead a huge art project like all of these other artists under conditions which were as difficult as I had thought they would be. And I was not sure we were going to actually succeed.
It's a very harsh environment. It's not just 100 degrees in the day, but you might have high winds in a windstorm and be needing to be in sort of find your way through a whiteout with middle of a dust storm.
But it becomes second nature. Before you go, before you walk 10 steps, every person there who's thinking has water with them, enough water to last them for several hours, a hat, sunscreen, something to protect their face for when the windstorms come up. You kind of learn that pretty fast. And if you don't, people around you will help you a little bit with that.
It does seem like a wonderfully nurturing, supportive circle of 60,000 people. Is that actually what it's like when you're there?
Actually, yes, because the core idea, there's no commerce at Burning Man. You're not buying or selling. You put your wallet away. You're never using money when you're out there. You bring enough for yourself. Radical self-reliance is one of the initial principles. But giving, sharing is the other core principle. So you bring enough for yourself and you also bring something to give.
To their credit, one of the things that the Burning Man organization tries to do is have roughly a 50-50 mix of people who've been to Burning Man before and who understand the culture of Burning Man and people who are brand new. And I think that they're going to face some challenges as they scale up because inevitably they're just more new people now. I had not seen any garbage, for example, on the playa at Burning Man last year. I saw a little bit of that this year. It was anecdotal, but I think that they're going to have some form of, and they do try to do this, but I think they're going to have to do a little bit more on the acculturation of kind of the general populace even before they hit the playa as they get larger and larger.
This Burning Man phenomenon, putting it together and actually living it over the Labor Day weekend, it's sort of like a living lab of how to live an authentic life. I hate to get philosophical this early in the conversation, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's very much the intention behind the communities. Can we create a space, a place, a city where people feel that permission to truly be themselves, whatever that may be, without judgment? which was why it was so hard when they had to figure out how to judge who got to go when they didn't have enough to go around. But the general experience, people come in as maybe a tourist and then get blown away and then start having ideas. And they say, next year I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. We had that in our camp. Some kids came last year and said, wow, this is amazing. And next year I'm going to build something. And they learned how to weld and they built this big art car contraption, just like Katie in the film did. Yeah. You know, she went there, was blown away, and realized she wasn't doing with her life what she really wanted to be. She really had that creative spark inside. She really wanted to be an artist, and going to Burning Man inspired her to actually go do that. Then you're surrounded by a community of people that when you say that, you say, you know what, I'm not really meant to be an accountant. I want to be a DJ, and I don't want to be a nanny. I want to be an artist. You're surrounded by a community of people that say, how can I help you? And that's a great thing to do. When you're down here in your kind of normal life, you might want to say you're going to do a radical change like that, and people you're around say, you're crazy, don't do it. But up there, everyone says, go for it. But it gets people in trouble too, because then you go to the desert, you have this epiphany, you come down from the mountain and say, I'm going to now do this new thing with my life. That leads to a roller coaster of challenges and hard work that you have to work through. And that was essentially the story of the film. When you do follow a dream, what happens next? There's a lot you have to figure out and work through and compromises you have to make. You find that interface between the real you and the way the world works.
Well, and again, another population that you see, another challenge for Burning Man that you see in the film is what's called these plug-and-play camps. And they're camps where people can come to varying degrees and get taken care of already and have, whether it's RVs set up or whether it's they have people already decorating their cars. And Burning Man wants to be inclusive of people like that. But then on the other hand, their question to themselves is, are those people getting enough of the experience and kind of working through enough of the hardships, which they view as, you know, Will Rogers says, the cauldron that cooks their souls. Like that occurs when you're actually tested as a person, when you're challenged, right? And if you come into these camps and are too taken care of without any actually having to deal with the reality of life out there, what does that do? And are you, as Harley says, are you getting it? So yeah. It's interesting.
And there's also this tension between freedom and having rules. I love the way you talk about that in the film and seeing people try to work through that philosophically. I think it's a great lesson for anybody, even if they never want to go to Burning Man.
This was like a real-time living view of stuff that we read about in college, you know, freshman Western culture class. We're trying to create societies that allow people to reach their full potential and have freedom. But if you have theoretically too much freedom, then you end up having no freedom because it leads to chaos. And that Burning Man went through that in 96, and they came out the other side saying, if we're going to grow and have this last, we need to have some level of order. And Larry has these great statements. Larry Harvey, the founder, has these great statements. So they started off as the anarchists who are organizing this event, and they basically had to become the government.
They try to operate as a consensus-based organization. We jump through some serious hoops and kind of reprove and prove ourselves again. By the time we get to the ticket crisis, we've already spent months with them in their boardroom at some very long meetings where we're just kind of like, okay, you know, and just kind of being there. And so they're completely used to us. By that, we didn't want to be ambulance chasers. We literally just wanted to follow their story. Then we knew there would be a story over the course of a year of being with them, but we didn't know what that story would be. But they had trust by the time we got to something interesting. They trusted us and really didn't see our cameras so much anymore.
We knew that they were at an inflection point where they were dealing with legacy and succession and growth and making a difference in the world. We knew they were dealing with those issues. We didn't quite know which crisis, which challenges they would hit. We knew there'd be something.
Steve Brown and Jesse Dieter are the producers of a documentary called Spark, a profile of the Burning Man Festival. Up next, the second part of the Burning Man interviews and an effort to create a barter economy in New York City. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1266. It's free. The Burning Man Festival is like the love child of the 60s hippies and the members of the Chess Club. Creativity, inventiveness, and sharing are encouraged. Selling, any kind of selling, is banned. Producers Steve Brown and Jesse Dieter profiled the festival in their film Spark. Here's part two of their conversation with Andrea Chase.
Talk a little about what the ticket fiasco was.
So they've been growing every year, and they have a cap. They had a cap on how many people could be out there because it's on public land. They have to get a permission from the government to have the event on public land, and it's for a capped number of people. And they had been growing and growing and hadn't hit that cap yet. They just barely hit the cap in 2011, but not enough that anyone noticed. But if they just follow the growth line, they knew that they were going to have way more demand than they had supply in 2012. So they knew they were going to have to deal with this issue of how do they decide who gets to go and who doesn't get to go. And what they, the interesting thing for us to see in witnessing them debate this in the boardroom is it was all about their core principles. In a normal event, then a music festival would say, oh, there's too much demand, we're sold out, that's good, let's raise the prices. But in Burning Man, their core principles are about radical inclusion. We include everyone. Or radical self-expression, which means true permission to be yourself without any judgment. If they're going to be the judge to decide who can go and who can't go, then are you still really yourself? You know, are you pitching yourself to prove you're good enough to go? So they were wrestling with these core, fundamental, seemingly irreconcilable principles for the first time.
But that's why we chose to include people say, oh, well, the ticket crisis, it's not actually that big a deal. But it is for them. The fact of the matter is that it's such a big deal for them because it did call in everything, as Larry later called it, the ticker kerfluffle. But it represented so many aspects of what's important to those people and why they still do what they do after a quarter of a century that we thought it really wonderfully illustrated all of these things that we wanted to get out in the film.
Yeah, and it wasn't the first time they'd had a problem because for a long time you could just go up to Black Rock and buy a ticket and go in, and they finally had to stop doing that.
Well, so, I mean, you look at the growth of a community in the first kind of threshold event was when it got too big and they didn't have enough order, and so it nearly fell apart because it kind of devolved into chaos. And then they created a kind of well-governed community that was sustaining it. And then what happens to your community and your principles when you hit scarcity? Our whole economy kind of revolves around scarcity. The prices go up when it's scarce, and you know that we have hierarchies and everything because of scarcity. And their whole ideal was the opposite of that. So that was a big, big test for their core ideals of what happens when there's scarcity.
I was thinking about the logistics of making this film and just the logistics of preparing and of filming and then of editing and all of that. When you decide you're going to do this, what's the first thing you do? Do you make a list? Do you invoke a saint? Do you burn sage?
There were lists and saints and sage. And I mean, this project grew exponentially from Steve's initial vision, and we had to kind of both decide, you know, there were some pretty interesting like do or die moments where we had to both decide that we were going to be completely on board because this was such an overwhelmingly massive endeavor that we knew that was going to be, you know, it for the next basically 2 years. I mean, we haven't had weekends for a year. I mean, like, period, because it's kind of like that. And you also have to be flexible because things have continually evolved and changed, and we've lost characters. And we start, you know, you start off with more than a dozen characters you're following over the course of, we were only filming for about 13 months. But then, you know, you're following so many things, and to keep your through line and to jettison things that aren't making sense when they no longer do and you get something better is really a challenge.
Well, I think the biggest challenge is when you're following, there's so many stories involving Burning Man, and we had to follow a lot of people to be there when things are happening. Because, you know, we weren't getting people to tell their war stories. We wanted to be there as the story was unfolding, and that takes a huge investment of time to be there with the cameras rolling in case it's happening. We were incredibly lucky to be there at all these pivotal moments in the stories that we followed. And then we get back to the playa where all these stories we've been following for a year, they're all converging and need to have an ending. So you have all these things happening all at the same time. So we had multiple crews going at the same time. You know, we were divide and conquer. Jesse had a small team and I had a small team and we had a couple of other teams that were out there because we had to follow a bunch of things all in parallel.
After watching this board work as a consensus group rather than a democracy, what was the long-term effect on you? What did you learn from that?
So I've been in a lot of boardrooms and a lot of board meetings, and in the default world, board meetings are usually, in the end, something to do with money. And what was really fascinating to see is this group of people who were not motivated by money. They're motivated by ideals and principles. And in their boardrooms, despite what people might suspect is going on behind the scene, when we're there behind the scenes, we see that what their debates are about is about principles and ideals.
And money too, actually. Logistics.
Logistics, not about money.
It's not about making more money, but about logistics.
Money as a tool rather than money as an end in itself.
It costs a lot of money and then for them to put the event on, and then everybody wants a piece of them. Every government agency and everybody they interact with along the way wants a piece of them. But it's not run like a business, per se. I mean, it really is run by a bunch of artists who are sort of figuring that side of it out.
I was just impressed that they really tried to adhere to their ideals in the running of the ship. And the meetings we have on meta discussions on how they're going to talk and deal and interface with each other is really wonderful in its idealism.
The film is Spark, a Burning Man story, and I'm Andrea Chase.
So what do you do if you want to create a local economy that doesn't rely on cash, one that goes all year round? Modern alternative economy movements like the Transitions Movement encourage local barter economies. And in New York City, there's a web-based effort to bring the barter economy into today's world. It started with a group of artists who created a system where you could barter to learn new skills. That idea launched a barter site called OurGoods.org.
On Manhattan's Lower East Side, Eve Pollock is teaching a group of people how to swing dance. But unlike most things in New York City, the class doesn't cost any money. Instead, students are required to barter for something the instructor would like. It's part of a new initiative called the Trade School. In Eve's case, she just asked for enthusiasm. But she thinks the notion of free exchange has lots of potential.
Yeah, I think bartering is beautiful because it emphasizes the skills and the love and the friendship instead of the monetary value.
Rich Watts is one of the 5 co-founders of the Trade School. He actually obtained the space where the classes were being held by bartering.
I bartered work. I bartered time. And they were into that.
The space actually functioned as the physical counterpart to the barter website, Our Goods. Another co-founder, Caroline Woolard, says barter is a process that requires some face time.
Barter is a nuanced relationship. It's something where you have to find someone whose skill set and personality work with yours on some level. So having a storefront allows a wider network of people to get to know each other over time.
And getting to know each other is required if a barter system is really going to work. That's according to economist Daniel Martin. He's a PhD candidate at NYU who advised the group.
Certainly you develop a relationship with the people that you buy from. So when you buy your coffee in the morning, you develop a relationship with those people. So regular exchange has relationships embedded in it. But I think barter, in particular these kinds of networks, have an even more social aspect to them.
And being social is important if you hope to get by in hard times. That's when barter economies generally tend to crop up. Caroline Woolard says that in a recession, people who are unemployed can really benefit from figuring out how to trade.
We kind of see Our Goods working like Craigslist does in that regard, where they rolled out a Craigslist site for cities that could support a Craigslist site. And that's kind of the way we see Our Goods. We already have people who've been contacting us from Cleveland, and we have people who are in San Francisco, Philadelphia, who are interested in starting Our Goods. And as soon as the site is ready, that we think it's ready to kind of spread like that, we'll launch in different areas.
Back in New York, Deirdre Sawinski and Brad Williams were at the swing dance lesson, where they were still working out what a proper trade would entail.
I don't know what people would trade for my skills, but I think it's kind of fun. It's a great idea to see what you're worth.
Deirdre is a belly dancer, and she's thinking of teaching classes. And she asked, what should I barter for? And I told her, just get cat toys, because you like watching your cat play with them.
Find out more at OurGoods.org and TradeSchool.coop. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at WAMC.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there. And you can also email me at sbarnett@WAMC.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.